Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the 28th video for the Old Testament Survey course. In this section, we'll begin looking at the poetic books, starting with the book of Job. Job is a very interesting book, a very deep and philosophical book that can be difficult to understand at times. There are long arguments that can be hard to follow, yet it is a very rewarding book to read and understand. And I think the main idea, the main point of the book of Job, is very clear and very important. But first, some background issues. The author of Job is anonymous. We just don't know who wrote this book. And so, knowing who wrote it is not necessary for understanding and applying it. And in the same way, the date it was written is unknown. The story of Job is set in the time of the patriarchs, but we don't know if the story was written down at that time or written much later. And in terms of this book's place in the Bible, in the Greek and English Bibles, Job is placed before Psalms because it was thought to be before the monarchy. And in the Hebrew Bible, it is placed after Psalms and before Proverbs. Now, let's look at the organization of the book of Job. The outline of Job clearly starts with a narrative prologue. There was a wager in heaven. Job suffered greatly and then complained about it. And the book of Job ends with a separate narrative epilogue. God set things right, and Job has a happy ending. Both the prologue and epilogue are very important to understand the rest of the book. And we should read all the arguments in the rest of the book in light of the prologue and epilogue. Both are narrative, and the rest of the book is poetry. After the prologue is a series of dialogues. Job and his three friends argue back and forth about why Job suffered. And there are three cycles of dialogues that go back and forth. Job speaks, and Eliphaz responds. Job responds, and then Bildad responds. And then Job responds to him, and finally Zophar responds. It goes through this series of speakers three times in the dialogues. And then near the end of the book are three longer monologues. These are longer passages where only one person is speaking. Job has his final say in a longer speech without any input from his friends. And then Elihu put in his two cents. And then God gets the final word. And God's final word includes a bit of reaction from Job. But at the heart of the book is the hymn of wisdom in chapter 28. This passage raises and answers the most pressing issue for the entire book. Where is wisdom found? Who has wisdom? In other words, who's qualified to give the answers to the questions raised by this book? And notice by the structure of the book that this central section and God's monologues are stressed as the most important parts of the book. Now, let's dive into the content of the book of Job, starting with some key verses. The first is Job 1, verse 1, which says, "In the land of Uz there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil." Now, this passage introduces the story, but it also makes a very important point that Job was blameless and upright. He feared God and avoided evil. Both of those phrases, and even the precise words used, will be very important later in the book. And this answers a key question that will be raised later in the book in the very first verse. Job was upright. He did not deserve the suffering that he would experience. Next is Job chapter 1, verses 20 and 22, and chapter 2, verse 10, which say, "At this, Job got up and tore his robes and shaved his head. Then he fell to the ground in worship and said, 'Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised.' In all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing." And later, Job replied to his wife, "You are talking like a foolish woman. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble? In all this, Job did not sin in what he said." Now, these passages, like the previous one, clearly establish that Job was innocent, and he did not deserve the suffering he experienced. Nor did he did he deserve the accusations that his friends would throw at him? That issue is settled for the reader at the beginning of the book, so that when Job's friends question his innocence and accuse him, the reader already knows better. Then in Job chapter 3, verse 1, it says, "After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth." This verse is after Job had suffered the loss of all his property, most of his family, and his health. And he, understandably, was miserable. He went so far as to say it would have been better had he not been born. And this demonstrates the severity of his suffering. Next is Job 6, verses 1 through 3 and 8 through 10. "Then Job replied, 'If only my anguish could be weighed and all my misery be placed on the scales, it would surely outweigh the sand of the seas. No wonder my words have been impetuous. Oh, that I might have my request, that God would grant what I hope for, that God would be willing to crush me, to let loose his hand and cut me off. Then I would still have this consolation, my joy in unrelenting pain, that I had not denied the words of the Holy One.'" This passage also gives expression to the intensity of Job's suffering, so much that he wanted to die, but Job also expressed his innocence in all the suffering. Then is Job 19, verses 4 through 7 and 21 through 27, where Job replied to his accusers, "If it is true that I have gone astray, my error remains my concern alone. If indeed you would exalt yourself above me and use my humiliation against me, then know that God has wronged me and drawn his net around me. Though I cry, 'I've been wronged,' I get no response. Though I call for help, there is no justice. Have pity on me, my friends, have pity, for the hand of God has struck me. Why do you pursue me as God does? Will you never get enough of my flesh? Oh, that my words were recorded, that they were written on a scroll, that they were inscribed with an iron tool on lead, or engraved in rock forever. I know that my Redeemer lives, and that in the end he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God. I myself will see him with my own eyes, I and not another. How my heart yearns within me." In this passage, Job expressed his frustration in a few directions. First, he challenged his friends for being lousy counselors and accusing him instead of consoling him. Then he complained that God had wronged him by bringing this misery when he did not deserve it. And then he expressed his wish for justice and for the record to be set straight. And finally, he expressed his hope against hope that he would find justice even after the grave, that somehow someone would act as Redeemer in his case. Next is Job chapter 28, verses 12 through 13 and 20 through 28 from the Hymn of Wisdom. And this says, "But where can wisdom be found? Where does understanding dwell? Man does not comprehend its worth. It cannot be found in the land of the living. Where then does wisdom come from? Where does understanding dwell? It is hidden from the eyes of every living thing, concealed even from the birds of the air. Destruction and death say, 'Only a rumor of it has reached our ears.' God understands the way to it, and he alone knows where it dwells. For he views the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. When he established the force of the wind and measured out the waters, when he made a decree for the rain and a path for the thunderstorm, then he looked at wisdom and appraised it. He confirmed it and tested it. And he said to man, 'The fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. And to shun evil is understanding.'" Now, this passage is at the center of the book, addressing the central question of who has wisdom to answer life's difficult questions. And the answer is that God alone does. And God has told humanity all we need to know, that the fear of the Lord is wisdom, and to avoid evil is understanding. And notice that those exact phrases, fearing God and avoiding evil, were used to describe Job in the first verse of this book. Then is Job 38, 1 through 4, which says, Then the Lord answered Job out of the storm. He said, "Who is this that darkens my counsel with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me if you understand." Now, this passage is the very beginning of God's response to Job. And God does not answer questions. God asks questions. He challenged Job's right to question God and also challenged Job's ability to comprehend the things that only God can understand. Then is Job chapter 40, verses 1 through 14. The Lord said to Job, "Will the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? Let him who accuses God answer him." Then Job answered the Lord, "I am unworthy. How can I reply to you? I put my hand over my mouth. I spoke once, but I have no answer. Twice, but I will say no more." Then the Lord spoke to Job out of the storm. "Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Would you discredit my justice? Would you condemn me to justify yourself? Do you have an arm like God's, and can your voice thunder like his? Then adorn yourself with glory and splendor, and clothe yourself in honor and majesty. Unleash the fury of your wrath. Look at every proud man and bring him low. Look at every proud man and humble him. Crush the wicked where they stand. Bury them all in the dust together. Shroud their faces in the grave. Then I myself will admit to you that your own right hand can save you." In this passage, God continued his questioning of Job, and Job reacted with a brilliant response. He repented. He acknowledged that he was talking about things he did not know, and he shut up. But God continued to press the point. He challenged Job to do better than God does in running the moral universe and doing justice. Job had complained about God's justice, and so God said, "Okay, show me how it's done, smart guy." And that brings us to Job 42, verse 1 through 7. Then Job replied to the Lord, "I know that you can do all things. No plan of yours can be thwarted. You asked, 'Who is this that obscures my counsel without knowledge?' Surely I spoke of things I did not understand, things too wonderful for me to know. You said, 'Listen now and I will speak. I will question you and you shall answer me.' My ears had heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes." After the Lord had said these things to Job, he said to Eliphaz the Temanite, "I am angry with you and your two friends because you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has." Now, this passage tells Job's second response, and like the first, it is appropriate. Job acknowledged that he was wrong to question God because he's not in the same category as God, and he repented. And at the end of the passage, God gives the evaluation that Job had spoken rightly and his friends had not. And finally is Job 42, verses 10 through 12. This says, "After Job had prayed for his friends, the Lord made him prosperous again and gave him twice as much as he had before. The Lord blessed the latter part of Job's life more than the first." This passage is the happy ending of the book. God restored all that Job had lost and even more. If this book did not have a happy ending, then God's justice could be questioned. The problem with Job, like sometimes with us, is that God's justice was questioned before the ending had come. All right, those are some of the key ideas in the book of Job. And now let's go look more deeply at the content of Job, starting with the narrative prologue. There are actually two rounds in the intro. Both follow the same pattern. They're very similar. First, Satan approaches God, and God confronts Satan about what he's doing there. Satan basically sasses God, trying to imply that God is failing with humans. And then God brings up Job. Job is given as an example of godliness and humans living in right relationship with God. And Satan accuses Job. That's what he does. He's an accuser. He tries to turn God against Job, not Job against God. He says Job only serves God for the reward. Now, that's an accurate accusation for some people who serve God only for what they get out of it and not because they love God. That kind of mercenary faith does not honor God and is not really true faith. And the devil accused Job of having that kind of attitude. And then God granted the accuser permission to harm Job within clear restraints. Satan can only do what God has specifically allowed him to do. God remains fully in control of all that happens to Job. And then Satan does his worst to Job. He takes away his wealth, kills most of his family, and then gives him horrible, painful maladies. And Job responds with worship and does not sin. But this faithful response from Job is toned down in the second round of the prologue. Job was reeling and his faith was beginning to waver, yet he did not sin. And that brings us to the problem of Job, the surface issue that Job addresses. First, Job is righteous, but then Job suffers. Do you see the problem? This calls into question Deuteronomistic theology, and this calls into question God's justice. And the rest of the book struggles with this problem and offers various solutions. Deuteronomistic theology, that God blesses the righteous and punishes the wicked, it is the general rule. But I think it cannot be pressed hard and fast in every specific situation. The general rule is always true, all other things being equal. But all things are not always equal. For instance, it is a general rule that if you drive carefully, you will avoid an accident. That is true for the most part. But it doesn't take into account other drivers, mechanical failures, or icy roads. So there's more going on here than just Deuteronomistic theology. It is more than a question of Job's righteousness and reward. And as I mentioned earlier, one of the issues is the time gap between the act and the reward and punishment. Sometimes there is a time lapse before the consequences. If we were rewarded or punished immediately, this would teach us to be good for selfish reasons, which would train us in sin and hypocrisy. But as it is, this delay can train us in faith, that we trust God's promises and threats, even when they are tested. Now, let's skip to the end of the book and look at the epilogue. We see that at the end of the story, God sides with Job. He says that Job spoke what was right, and God rules against the three friends. Therefore, we need to read all the rest of the book, knowing that in all the arguments, ultimately Job is right and his friends are wrong. Now, that does not mean that everything Job says is right or that everything the friends say is wrong. But the overall approach and conclusions are right and wrong, respectively. And God ignores Elihu. He doesn't even give his monologue a response, which I think says something about it. And God blesses Job. He gave him double the property and the same number of children. And notice that God never explained to Job the events of the introduction or the answer to his questions. Job is left completely in the dark about why all these things happened to him, because that is not what is important for Job to know in this story. Job's lessons are much more important than that. And so that brings us to the questions addressed in the book of Job. First, is Job righteous? Remember that he was described in the intro as upright and blameless, fearing God and turning away from evil. So this seems like a no-brainer, and I think it is. But this question is at the heart of the dialogues with his friends because they were misapplying Deuteronomistic theology. And second, is God just? Again, this seems like an easy question, and I think it really is, but this is questioned and debated throughout the book. And third, who has wisdom? In other words, who is qualified to judge and answer these questions? And the final question is, does Job serve God only for God's blessings? This is the accusation that the devil made at the start and it is tested throughout the book. And I also want to point out a non-question. By that, I mean a common question that is not directly addressed in this book. The book of Job never asks the question, why do the innocent suffer? Job and his friends never found out why Job suffered, and they never address this question in those terms. And the reader already knows from the intro why Job was suffering. Now, I think the book of Job has a lot to say to this question, but not in the way you might expect. And whenever I am asked why the innocent suffer in those terms, I point out that only one man was ever truly righteous. And the reason he suffered was because he was crucified for our sins to purchase our salvation. Problem solved. Now, I want to try to survey the dialogues and monologues of this book by summarizing the arguments of each group. We'll start with the perspective of Job's so-called friends. Now, I put friends in inverted commas because they are his friends, but in this book, they don't act like friends. They argue that the wicked are always punished, period. God only rewards the righteous, never allows the righteous to suffer. The wicked suffer. Does that sound familiar? And because of this, they conclude that because Job is suffering, therefore Job is guilty, and he should repent. And they grow more and more aggressive in their accusation as the dialogues progress. At first, they were sympathetic to Job and comforting, but by the end, they were accusing him of being the worst sinner ever. On the one hand, they rightly had the perspective of Deuteronomistic theology. But on the other hand, they were overly simplistic and naive in the way that they applied it. They thought that they were wise enough to dictate how it works out in every circumstance. They had the right theology, but they didn't apply it with wisdom. And they didn't apply it with compassion. They were harsh and uncaring toward Job, kicking him when he was down. They took what they truly knew and forced God to conform to their understanding. They could not conceive of the possibility that God would do things beyond their narrow conception and viewpoint. They allowed their theology to distort reality. So the three friends said some true things, but overall they were wrong. Now let's look at Job's perspective. Job's speeches basically go back and forth between two directions. He spoke in reply to his friends, rebuffing their accusations and criticizing their lack of compassion, and he spoke in anguish to God, asking for help, asking for answers, asking for resolution. Job said, "I'm innocent. I don't deserve this level of suffering." He also said, "I'm miserable. This sucks." He cursed his birth and said it would be better if he had never been born. And he said, "My so-called friends aren't helping, but they're hurting." He said, "If they just kept their mouths shut, they'd be better comforters." And he said, "I'm innocent." Now, I know I already said this, but I'm repeating it because Job kept repeating it. And Job kept bringing it up because his friends kept bringing it up. Job continually needed to keep denying his guilt. And Job said, "I want to ask God why this is happening to me." He even went so far as to question God's running of the moral universe. He denied that the wicked are always punished. Remember that not everything Job said was right either, as we'll see when God answers him. And Job said, "I wish I could talk to God about what is happening, but God is too far above for him to answer me. I can't reach him to present my case." Job was seeking answers. He was blindly searching in the dark, as it were, but he was searching. He was groping and therefore going beyond the conventional wisdom of his friends. And by doing so, he came very close to New Testament teaching about resurrection and eternal judgment. And he said, "God is so far removed, I need an intermediary to go between." In chapter 9, verse 33, Job called on God to help him speak to God. It doesn't make complete sense, but like I said, Job was just grasping. But he hit on the New Testament idea of a mediator between God and man, who can relate to both. And finally, Job said, I have hope against hope that somehow God will make it right. Even if I die, I will somehow see my Redeemer and my redemption. Now, in terms of the monologues, for time's sake, I'm not going to summarize Elihu's perspective. He's the voice of the angry youth who think they know it all. He arrogantly judged Job and his friends for not finding the answers. He was frustrated that they did not solve the problem and put Job in his place. But he didn't really add anything to the discussion that had not already been said. And God ignored Elihu, as we've seen. We'll come back to God's monologues in a minute. But before we get there, let's explore Job chapter 28, the hymn on wisdom. It starts by raising the question, where is wisdom found? It says, earthly treasure can be found. People go to great lengths and have great ingenuity and success in finding gold and precious minerals. And wisdom is more precious than treasure. However, man cannot find wisdom on his own. It is beyond our ability to know wisdom. However, God can find wisdom. God knows all wisdom because it's from him. True wisdom is from God. Mankind has figured out mining. We've figured out electricity, technology, genetics, etc. And all the scientific and technological success tends to blind people to the reality that man has totally failed to figure out the things that really matter. We have cool phones, but wasted lives. We have limitless information, but no wisdom and no peace. Man has no way to find true wisdom except for God. And yet wisdom can be known, because God has revealed true wisdom, because God has revealed himself, and he has made it known that true wisdom is the fear of the Lord and turning away from evil. Remember Job. He's blameless and upright, fearing God and turning away from evil. That is wisdom. Therefore, if we want to be wise, we should stand in awe of God and flee from sin and everything that is not pleasing to him. That is wisdom, according to the book of Job. Now, let's return to the monologues by looking at God's speeches to hear God's perspective, which, of course, is the true and correct evaluation of everything covered in this book. But first, a parenthetical point that comes directly out of God's speeches, and that is that God is awesome. God's point in the speeches is to answer Job, not necessarily to describe himself, but from his speeches, we gain insight about God's greatness, power, wisdom, and his care for even the smallest details of his creation. We should hear God's message to Job, but we should also be awed by who he is. Now, back to God's perspective. The fact that God speaks at all is in itself a profound answer. He does care. He does not leave Job hanging, and he does not leave his justice questioned. God's speeches are gentle, but very firm with Job. There's no question who is in authority in this discussion. In God's first speech, he challenged Job's ignorance. He did not answer Job's questions, but he asked questions of his own. He changed the subject. Not only do Job and his friends have the wrong answers, they're not even asking the right questions. So God challenged Job's understanding. He pointed out that Job doesn't understand creation. Now, to us, creation is a chaos with complexity beyond our imagination. But to God, it is a cosmic dance completely under his control. Job doesn't understand the weather. It is a chaos beyond our comprehension, and yet it also completely under God's control. Job doesn't understand wild animals. Job doesn't even understand the domestic animals that he works with every day. The point is that God is in control, even if it doesn't appear so to our limited understanding. Chapter 38, verse 36 stresses that God is the source of wisdom and understanding. In other words, This is an argument from lesser to greater. If Job has no handle whatsoever on these natural things, how can he presume to be able to address the problem of evil? How can he contend with and correct God? The physical world, which Job does not understand, is well within God's control. And so, Job is invited to make the conclusion that the moral order, which he also does not understand, is equally as glorious, equally complex, and yet equally under God's control and command. Therefore, Job can have confidence in the working out of the moral world, just like he has confidence that the rain will fall. And then God's final challenge of this section is, will the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? Let him who accuses God answer him. And Job makes a brilliant response. He says, I am unworthy. I cannot reply. I will shut up now. Job understood from God's answer that he was not in a position to understand what was going on, let alone complain about it. And then God pressed ahead with his second speech. In that section, he challenged Job's littleness and inability. God said, I will question you again. Do you discredit me to justify yourself? Now, Job was rightly puzzled by his moral problem, but the solution that he chose was to try to throw God's justice under the bus. And God responded by pointing out how inappropriate that is. He asked, are you as strong as God? Then by all means, do better. Why don't you work justice in the world? And then I will be impressed. And the implication of this is that you can't. Why are you criticizing the way that I do justice? And God continued about Job's lack of power. He asked, can you control the behemoth or leviathan? Now, those were two creatures far beyond Job's strength. But God said, I can. I treat them like pets. You can't control them. You have no power. So how can you presume to control the moral universe? Now, this might seem like God was just browbeating and belittling Job or pulling the power trip to shut him up. But that's not what was going on. God was actually being very gracious to Job by helping him to accurately see his own place in the universe. And this was in order to lead up to the point and final challenge of this section. The question was, what makes you think that you're able to know? Why do you assume that you're able to understand what's going on here? The point is that Job was not qualified to make these judgments, or even to dialogue with God about these things. They are way over Job's head. They are beyond his ability and station. And again, this was not a put down to win an argument, but it was an honest appraisal of the situation. There's some things that you just don't explain to a toddler, not because you're hiding it from them, but because they cannot yet understand. And then Job's reply echoed what God had said and then responded. Job said, I know you can do all things. No one thwarts your plans. Now, by the way, many Christians want to solve the problem of evil by appealing to free will, but the book of Job seems to argue against that because no one thwarts God's plans. And then Job parroted God's first question in 38:2. God had said, who obscures my counsel without knowledge? And Job responded to that question by admitting, I spoke of things I did not understand, things too wonderful for my knowledge. And God had said, I will question and you shall answer me, back in chapter 40, verse 7. And Job responded, I had heard, but now I see. I despise myself and repent. Job admitted that he had spoken about things beyond his ability. Job confessed that God is God and Job is not, that they are not on the same level. Now, notice what Job did not say. Job did not say, okay, I see it all now. You have successfully explained it and you have lived up to my standards. He did not say, now I see the whole picture. I withdraw the charges because I have judged you innocent. Rather, he realized, now I see that I don't understand. I am beyond my element. I am in over my head. Job did not get an answer to his questions, but he got a more important and valuable lesson. He got an understanding of who he is in relationship to God and of God's relationship to his question. God is God, and God knows, and God is in control, and God can be trusted. And that is more than enough for us to know and count on, even in difficult suffering. Now, let me try to draw some conclusions from this discussion. There is much wisdom in knowing the limit and the contingency of human wisdom. This book challenges the kind of arrogance that thinks we can figure everything out. This rebukes our trusting in our own abilities. There are some questions that are just beyond us. We need revelation from God. We are dependent. We are contingent. And we need humility like a child to realize this. The friend's fallacy was that they overestimated their own grasp of wisdom. They decided for themselves what God must do and how. And we're in the same situation as they were. We are just as incapable of figuring out the mystery of why God does things the way he does. And we cannot totally rely on our own judgment because we are unable to fully understand how the moral universe works. And therefore, we need to clearly grasp that God is not obligated to explain himself to fallen human beings. He does not have to account for everything to his children. And we're arrogant beyond measure if we demand that he do so. Now, I know that that answer is not satisfactory to curious skeptics, but it is biblical, and therefore it's the wisest possible answer. I honestly wish that I could tell you exactly why everything happens. I wish I could answer all your questions, but I would be lying if I said I could, and I'd be making the same mistake as Job's friends. That is not the path to wisdom. Rather, trusting God is. So finally, let's look at the theological themes of Job by revisiting the questions posed by this book. First, is God just? And the immediate answer is yes, of course he is. But I think the better answer is actually to disavow this question. Just by whose standards? Are we qualified to judge if God is just or not? The book of Job leaves absolutely no room whatsoever for the idea that God is responsible to us or answerable to us. God asked the questions, not us. If God had answered Job on his own terms, it would have been to imply that God must answer to humans. And God will not allow us to think that. Now, of course, God is just and perfectly moral in all that he does. But it is not our place to stand in judgment of him. The next question is, who has wisdom? God does. That's who. And he has revealed all that we need to know about wisdom. The fear of the Lord is wisdom, and turning away from evil is understanding. And the question of why do the righteous suffer? The book of Job lets us know that we're unqualified to completely and finally answer this question, and we are unable to understand something that is beyond our finite mind and our dependent situation. Now, there are some things we can know because God has revealed them, and we should pursue that kind of knowledge as far as we can. But we can't know everything. And we should not be overconfident in our own judgment in any situation. But you see, the book of Job is sneaky. We have been challenging the book of Job with our questions, but all the while, the book of Job has been challenging us with the real questions. We've been asking the questions, but now God turns it around and says, I have some questions for you. So let's look at the real questions, what the book of Job is really about. The book of Job challenges the readers with these questions. First, can God be trusted? Now, the obvious answer is yes. But that's an easy answer to give in a purely academic setting. What answer do we give when we're in the middle of suffering? Do we trust God in the dark? Do we trust God in situations when we're in over our head? Now, I hope that your faith is strengthened so that you will give the right answer even in difficult situations. When you suffer, hang on to the truth that God can indeed be trusted, even in your circumstances. And the second question is, do we serve God for blessings, or are we blessed because we serve God? And the related challenge to us is, will you still serve God if the blessings don't come immediately? Will we serve God if the blessings don't look like what we expected? Will we serve God even if the blessings are taken away? What do we love more, the blessings or God? Do we love God for himself or only for what he can give us? And then the final challenging question of Job is, are we content with creaturehood? That is, are we okay with having a creaturely dependence and the kind of wisdom which is fitting for a creature without aspiring to have a godlike wisdom which is beyond our reach? Do we serve God even when we don't understand? Are we okay with not having all the answers and with living by trust and not by sight? Remember back to the two parts of the very first temptation back in Genesis chapter 3. The first was to doubt God. Can God be trusted? And the second is to want to be like God. Are we content with creaturehood? Just to be clear again, we should learn and understand all that we can. Those things that God has put within our reach, we should strive for. But those things beyond our reach, we should stop where God's revelation stops and not speculate beyond what we can know. Heresies start that way. The right attitude is to love and trust in God, whether we understand or not. The right attitude is demonstrated in Psalm 131, which says, "My heart is not proud, O Lord. My eyes are not haughty. I do not concern myself with great matters or things too wonderful for me, but I have stilled and quieted my soul like a weaned child with its mother." That is the attitude that Job teaches us to strive for. So now, let's review what we've learned in Job. First, let's review the organization. The five sections are prologue, dialogues, hymn on wisdom, monologues, and epilogue. And notice that the organization puts emphasis on the hymn of wisdom. And let's review the ultimate questions of Job. They are, can God be trusted? Why do you serve God? And are you content to be a creature and let God be God? Now, I know this has been a lot of information and some deep philosophical stuff. I told you that Job is a deep and somewhat difficult book, but I hope from the survey that you've gained a better understanding of the book and have gained a clearer picture of your relationship to God and have received encouragement to trust him in every situation. In the next section, we will continue with the poetic books by looking at the book of Psalms. Thanks for watching.